London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK, London's premier forum for news, views, and up-to-date information. Here's Andy Udman.
It is 10:07 now on this Thursday, the 25th day of August. I get a lot of phone calls. I got a lot of email about different subjects we do, but none, no other topic competes with Pam Killeen for generating email. And some of it is nice, and some of it is not so nice. But lots of strong opinions whenever you come on. Pam, I appreciate you joining us again.
Thanks for having me on.
You're savvy, you're smart, and most of all, you're fearless. You don't care how much dirt they throw at you. Let's just talk about Pam Killeen for just a moment and what your agenda is. Because people always ask me, who is Pam Killeen and what does she want for me not to eat?
Mm-hmm. Well, basically, I do what I do because I was deathly ill for 12 years, and I had to do a lot of trial and error in terms of getting my health back. And so a lot of the choices I made in terms of my diet were actually counterproductive. They made me a lot sicker. So I had to delve deeply into diet to figure out how on earth, you know, diet can maintain health. And so I did a lot of digging and came to a lot of conclusions. And unfortunately, the conclusions that I arrived at are not mainstream. So it's a struggle to get this information out because we're up against, big food, and we're up against a lot of bad science. And unfortunately, you know, really what it comes down to is common sense, and people aren't paying attention to common sense.
What are the one or two most common misconceptions that people have about what they put in their mouths?
One of the biggest misconceptions has to do with the amount of animal fat that people are eating. Animal fat has been around for a long, long time. I mean, there's no history of a low-fat diet in the history of mankind. Animal fat and cholesterol are our friends, and they're not our enemies.
Pam Killeen describes herself, folks, if you haven't heard this before, because I chuckle every time I hear the expression, a recovering vegetarian. What do you mean by that?
Well, basically, I went on a diet that didn't have animal fat in it. When people are vegetarian or vegan, they have reduced their amount of animal fat in their diet and unfortunately can really, really throw off their biochemistry and have adverse effects on their health.
I often say to you, Pam, make this simple. And you often come back and you say, 3 square meals a day. That's what I'm preaching.
That's right, because before World War II, when we were eating adequate amounts of animal fat and we weren't fat phobic, cholesterol phobic, butter phobic, meat phobic, egg phobic, dairy phobic, I mean, we didn't have these phobias before World War II. And prior to World War II, we actually had a chance at health. We were much healthier than we are right now.
I have to confess something here. I'm a big fan of yours and everything you're saying for two reasons. One is because you want to make people healthier and you're passionate about that, and you have a very special guest coming up in just a moment. The other one is I now am shedding all this guilt about eating all the things that you just mentioned.
That's right. No, nobody should feel any guilt over these eating these foods. Unfortunately, you know, we're being told by experts that we should be on a low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet, and our upcoming guest did research to the contrary. He did a one-year study putting people on a high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet and got absolutely remarkable results. In terms of improved health and so on. Some of these people were able to either reduce or come off their medications. His research was actually summarized in a wonderful documentary, which has been airing on CBC for the last few years, and it's called My Big Fat Diet.
Which is just, I think, a great title, My mm-hmm. Big Fat Diet. If you'd introduce our guest this morning.
Right. Well, upcoming, we have Dr. Jay Wertmann. He's a clinical instructor at the UBC Faculty of Medicine. He also works for Health Canada as a senior medical advisor, and he conducted this wonderful study that I'd like to get him to summarize for us on air today.
Terrific. Doctor, appreciate you joining us this morning. From where?
My pleasure. I'm in West Vancouver.
West end of the country. Welcome to London, Ontario, and our audience this morning. A pleasure to have you.
My pleasure.
Are you also, and this label just makes me laugh, a recovering vegetarian?
I did laugh when I heard that a moment ago, and because that's exactly what I am.
What is a recovering vegetarian?
Well, you know, I was vegetarian for 17 years. Right up until the point where I developed a florid case of type 2 diabetes and literally stumbled into this whole new idea of not eating carbohydrates. But, yeah, I was a vegetarian.
Okay. Now, doctor, one of the things we love to do is encourage our audience to join in, and they're already joining in. John, you have a comment or a question?
Yeah, actually, a month ago I was diagnosed as, well, they say borderline diabetic. I went and saw a dietitian last week, and they're telling me, like, I should be eating more than what I am. They're telling me 45 carbs three times a week, or three times a day, plus eating snacks at 10, 3, and before I go to bed. Like, this is more than I ate before. 4 or 5 years ago, I was on a low-carb, high-protein diet, and I mentioned that, and they kind of said, no, that isn't the way you want to go. You want to eat, you know,
well, John,
carbs. And
John,
so
you
I
called
just wanted to get her feeling on that.
John, you've called it an excellent time. We put you right in with the doctor. You're first in line. Doctor, what would you say to John about his diabetic condition?
Well, it sounds like you might have what we call metabolic syndrome. Some people call that pre-diabetes. And metabolic syndrome and type 2 diabetes, the essential problem is that you've developed insulin resistance. And another way of saying insulin resistance is that you no longer have the ability to normally metabolize carbohydrates.
Right.
And in no other instance of a food intolerance do we prescribe the very food you can't tolerate, except for this one. So there's... Oh. Immediately, there's a disconnect here with the standard therapy and the advice that you're getting.
Doctor,
quick
question. How many Johns are there in the country? How many pre-diabetics and diabetics do we have out there?
The numbers are quite high. We know if you look at metabolic syndrome, which meets a certain definition, that about 25% of the adult population has that. And the number of people that, in addition, that just have insulin resistance is probably almost the same.
Did you say 25%?
Yes.
25%. South of the border, what would the figure be?
It's higher down there. But up here in some populations, it's higher. For instance, in the First Nations population, it's about 40%.
So what's your advice to John in terms of his diet?
Anyone who has insulin resistance usually responds very well to a carbohydrate-restricted diet. And the best guide right now, I think, out there is the new Atkins diet book.
The new Atkins, I wondered if you would promote any particular diet, the new Atkins diet book?
There's a new version of the book that was written by three very well-credentialed scientists in the U.S., and I think it's right now probably the best guide.
What about the South Beach diet while we're comparing diets?
The South Beach delivers results, but there's been a little bit of research that shows it's not as effective as the Atkins diet, because with this, when you develop insulin resistance, you get the best results if you get your carbs down really low and keep them low. And the Atkins diet has an induction phase. And for people that have insulin resistance, they should stay on that early phase of the Atkins diet indefinitely.
John, how much faith have you had in the advice that you've been getting about your pre-diabetic condition?
Not a whole lot. Like, I was on the Atkins diet about 4 or 5 years ago. I dropped a lot of weight. Now, the only problem that I found is when I started bringing the carbs back up, then I started putting weight back on and actually probably got heavier than what I was. I asked them about that, and their explanation to the Atkins diet and restricting your carbs was that you're actually dehydrating your body. I mean, I'm still restricting them, and I'm still keeping my blood sugar, where it needs to be. I have lost some weight, but, it's getting the conflicting stories. I just want, bottom line, this is what I should be doing and, kind of move on and not...
Okay, here it is.
Be guessing, sort of.
Dr. Wortman, we're going to break for a break in just a short moment, but John's asking just for a Reader's Digest version, 30 seconds, what are his marching orders?
Get the new Atkins diet book. Go on the induction phase and stay on it indefinitely. Read the whole book. It gives you good advice about a bunch of things like salt. But that works really well for people with type 2 diabetes or insulin resistance pre-diabetes.
Okay.
Does that work for you, John?
That works for me.
Terrific. I appreciate your call. Sure. We're going to take a short break back with Dr. Wortman, and we invite your calls as Dr. Wortman tells us about My Big Fat Diet. It's a fascinating story. And most of all, we really need to hear it, number one, to improve our health, and number two, so that sick people, and there are millions of them all around us, don't bankrupt the country as they are doing. We'll be back in just a moment, right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK. My Big Fat Diet. It was a fascinating thing they did on the CBC. It was to take a small town round up a bunch of fat people and get them to eat properly and see what the results were. Dr. Jay Wortman is the man behind it, and he's our guest this morning along with Pam Colleen. Dr. Jay, tell us how it came to be that you were involved in this experiment in this village, which led to the CBC documentary.
Well, I work for the part of Health Canada that provides health services to First Nations, and we are acutely aware that there's a huge problem with diabetes, type 2 diabetes, among First Nations. And when I discovered that my own diabetes responded very well to a low-carbohydrate diet, I connected the dots that we have this big epidemic in First Nations populations whose traditional diet was low in carbohydrate and who now have all these problems because they are eating a diet that's changed. So we decided that it would be an interesting thing to try because of the history of eating a low-carb diet in their recent past, their traditional diet, and transitioning them to another version of that in the current time frame and see if that helped.
Some of our audience are familiar with that CBC documentary, but just for those who are not, just walk us through what you did with this village.
We approached them and asked them if they'd like to try eating a diet that was similar to their traditional diet. In other words, all their traditional foods plus market foods that were low in carbohydrates. So they could add things that were non-traditional as long as they didn't have starch or sugar in them. And the community really embraced this idea, and we were able to run the study there. We recruited people. It was all done through the auspices of a university research project, and we recruited about 100 people into the study, but of course many more people in the village changed how they ate and to conform to the study diet.
Okay, just hold that thought. I want to get to the rest of the story in just a moment. Ingrid, thanks for calling. You have a question.
I don't really have a question. I actually
have a comment.
I found out through a neurologist that our brain is actually 75% fat. And that we need to eat more fat, like healthy fats, like fish oils. And I could see where the natives in the past, they ate a lot of fish.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Wortman, maybe you can describe a typical day's diet on this program.
Are you talking about the study diet?
About the study diet. I know you post this on the CBC website. They have actually a chart that people can take a look at to see what the typical diet would have looked like.
What we told them, basically what we did was we provided about a two-page list of foods they could eat, and it was all their traditional foods, plus, as I said earlier, market foods like meat, various meats that are non-traditional, any high-fat item except for the vegetable oils that are high in omega-6,
mm-hmm.
and dairy products, which were non-traditional items, but they could eat butter and cream. And cheese on the diet, mm-hmm. and all the non-starchy vegetables. And in the documentary, it was quite funny how they showed people suddenly developed a real fondness for cauliflower. So they could eat virtually anything we could eat as long as it didn't contain starch or sugar.
Okay, so what kinds of things did they have to ditch? Because just the idea of taking 100 people in a village and saying, would you work with us to not eat some of the things that you eat every day for a year? I mean, how do you get them to do that?
They did have to ditch some of their favorite foods. There was a real fondness for rice, pasta, bread was a big thing. And then, of course, all the things in the center aisle of the grocery store, all the chips and pop and sweets had to go out the window.
Mm-hmm.
Chips and pop. And what was the other one?
Sweets.
Sweets.
Now, some of these foods you're describing are actually pretty addictive foods. It's tough to come off those foods.
Some people find it very difficult to shake what I think is probably a sugar addiction, yes.
Well, absolutely. I went back to the web early this morning, and I was watching some of these people, and one of them made a very interesting comment. She says, we just, you know, talking about our health condition and how fat we were getting was just something we didn't want to talk about, so we just ignored it.
Yeah, I think it creeps up on you. I think that's human nature. You know, it's a slow process. It doesn't happen overnight. Yeah.
Well, now talking about the First Nations, and you talk about the history of their diet. Their diet historically was about 80% fat, correct?
The Inuit diet was notorious for being about 80% fat, 20% protein, and virtually zero carbohydrate. Other populations ate maybe a little bit more carbohydrate, but not a huge amount. And certainly on the West Coast, fat was the staple part of the diet. It was a central part of the diet.
Now, the fat, one of the benefits of the fat, of course, is it's very stabilizing for blood sugar levels.
Fat has the least impact on blood sugar of any of the foods you eat, yes.
Doctor, how many of our listeners right now are going, wait a minute, am I understanding this properly? I mean, because you're slaying a lot of sacred cows here.
Well, the way I look at it is that the evidence in the scientific literature is pretty clear that if you've developed insulin resistance, any condition related to insulin resistance, you've developed an intolerance to carbohydrates, and removing carbohydrates has a huge benefit to your health. It's a little bit of a jump to say that doing that before you develop insulin resistance is going to fix or prevent the problem. That's the area where it gets a little bit less clear. I think people can avoid those problems without going as extremely low carb.
Now, can you talk about some of the results you saw? A year, 100 people, a year study, eating traditional foods, basically. And what did you see happen at the end of the year?
Everything we saw was consistent with what we'd already learned in the scientific literature from this. And people lost a significant amount of weight. Their blood sugars improved. Their blood pressures improved. Their cholesterol, their lipid profiles improved. And many people who were on medication for blood sugar and blood pressure were able to get off those medications.
What was the reaction, Dr. J, from your colleagues across the medical world who seem to know so very little about nutrition?
It's an interesting thing. Medicine is practiced along the lines of people tend to follow clinical practice guidelines, which are generated by the big scientific authorities like the Diabetes Association and the Heart Association and so on. And so far, those authorities have not moved to any significant degree in this direction. So I'm usually up against a skeptical crowd when I talk to physicians, but I see changes. I've seen changes over the years now. There's more of an acceptance of this.
Now, we've had Gary Taubes on the show, and I know you communicate with him from time to time. It's a David and Goliath story. He's had some tremendous challenges trying to get through to people on the importance of eating animal fat.
Yes, I know Gary well, and I admire him. This has become the focus of his life after he started looking into the whole area of nutritional science. He saw a lot of problems with how the science has been done and the conclusions that people have reached, and yeah, he's on a bit of a crusade. I admire him for doing that.
Dr. J, in just a moment, we have to take a short news break, but I want to focus on two things. Taking a snapshot of where we are in North America in terms of our health, where that's going to lead in terms of our health, but also in terms of government budgets, because we're being swamped by medical bills, and then your advice on how we can change it, starting with what we have for lunch today. Would that work for you?
Sure.
We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. J. Wortman right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK. 10:34 now. I just want to share with you what we do during the commercial breaks, Pam and I. We just chat, and I wish you could sense the passion that Pam has for making people better. And she was just sharing with me in the last few minutes just people she runs into who are sick. You like to say we're sicker, fatter, and more depressed than we've ever been.
That's right.
And we keep running to the drugstore or the health club.
Or following fad diets, you know? I mean, we have history with our diets here. Lots and lots of precedents.
When we should be just going to the grocery store and getting what's on the outside wall, not the processed food in the center aisles.
Mm-hmm. Never buy anything that says low fat.
And it would make you better.
Yes. Yeah. Throughout the history of mankind, we were never fat phobic. We know the importance of animal fats.
You just gave me a couple of examples of people you've talked to in just the last few days who are literally sicker, fatter, and more depressed, which is becoming a huge issue in our society than we've ever.
Yeah, young people. I mean, I have people, I work with 4-year-old children who are deathly, deathly ill. I work with 20-year-old men who can't work, who can't finish university because they collapse with fatigue or depression. It's just people, unfortunately, are just falling through the cracks. And I think I've mentioned before on the show that anywhere between 50% and 80% of doctor visits today to GPs, for example, can be for psychological issues, things like stress, things like fatigue, depression, sleep problems. And I think a lot of these problems are being caused by malnutrition, and that's not something that's being addressed by the doctor.
That's why we have Pam Colleen on every Thursday, because brick by brick, step by step, we're going to improve the health of this city and hopefully the country. Again, for those who have just joined us, Pam, a brief introduction of our guest, Dr. J. Wortman.
Mm-hmm. Dr. J. Wortman is behind the study that is featured on the CBC documentary, My Big Fat Diet. He's a clinical instructor at the UBC Faculty of Medicine, and he also works for for Health Canada as a senior medical advisor.
Dr. Jay, let me ask you, what is the state of health of North America today?
Well, the biggest problem we're facing is, that, as Pam referenced, I think we've got a huge epidemic of chronic disease. The obesity epidemic is part of that, but also the epidemics of prediabetes and type 2 diabetes, which we talked about earlier. And there are a whole range of other problems that cluster around those particular issues. So we've got huge health problems that I think are so-called lifestyle diseases.
Now, with prediabetes, the tragic thing about prediabetes is that millions of people have it and don't know it.
This is true. When you develop insulin resistance, it can be silent for quite a while before you actually develop symptoms, but it's doing damage to you during that time.
Dr. J, you don't sound like the kind of guy who's likely in a parking lot to jump up on the hood of a car and start shouting at people as they go into the grocery store about what they should buy and shouldn't buy, but don't be afraid to get on your little soapbox here about the junk that we're eating and the health consequences.
Well, I think we eat a lot of junk, as you say, as a society. I think that does contribute to some of these problems.
Give us a short list. I want you to be really specific about, for example, you were talking about in the CBC documentary, My Big Fat Diet, what you asked them to ditch. Let's go through that again, just the top five items, and then we'll ask you to be very specific about what you steered them toward.
Well, let me frame it for you this way. What do I let my children eat? And my children don't get any pop. They don't get any sugary foods. They eat foods that we prepare for them. It's very rare that we buy fast food or that we buy pre-prepared foods. And I think if people follow that kind of dietary advice, they stick to the outside aisles of the supermarket. They follow the advice of Michael Pollan in his book, In Defense of Food. I think we would eliminate huge proportion of these chronic disease problems.
Well, Pam's got me convinced the only thing you should be drinking really is water. I mean, you meant in your little list there, the first thing you mentioned was pop.
Yeah.
Give me the Sermon from the Mount on pop. It is banned in our house. We don't see it. We allowed it only for birthday parties, just so people would come.
Yeah, well, the scientific literature in this area is pretty compelling that drinking liquid sugar is not good for anybody. And pop is the biggest offender.
You trying to put Coke and Pepsi out of business?
No, I don't. You know what? I'm a little different than a lot of people. I don't mind if you have a Diet Pop, Diet Coke or Diet Pepsi. A lot of people are fearful of the artificial sweeteners, but I'm not.
Okay, well, I know there's people who feel pretty strongly on the other side of the issue on that one. But Pam, I asked one day, what's the number one thing we could get out of our diet that would improve our health? And basically, she said sugar. Agree?
I generally agree with that. Yeah.
Yeah, and Dr. Robert Lustig, I'm sure you've been watching his research on fructose and high fructose corn syrup. Maybe you could comment a bit on that.
Lustig is a pediatric endocrinologist in San Francisco who's been on a bit of a crusade against fructose, which every sugar molecule is 50% fructose. High fructose corn syrup is a little bit more than 50% fructose. It's all pretty much the same, though, and I think the argument he's making is that people are consuming too much fructose and that this is one of the drivers of these problems.
Mm-hmm. Saw a piece last night on ABC about poverty in the United States. And, I mean, some shocking, shocking figures about how many kids go to school hungry. So what you end up doing is having parents of these children looking for the absolute cheapest food they can find. Where does that lead?
You know, this is one of the things that when we did our diet study, people were concerned about the cost of eating a low-carb, high-fat diet. So I actually went in the store and I measured the cost of a calorie of canola oil and the cost, I'm not saying people should fill their diet with canola oil, but as an example, the cost of a calorie of canola oil is cheaper than the cost of a calorie of flour. So I think people have misconceptions over which types of foods they should eat and misconceptions over the cost of a dietary change.
But overall, though, animal foods are going to be more expensive, I think, in the end, no? Or
generally true, yes.
Yeah, like butter and margarine, for example. I mean, margarine's significantly less than butter.
Yeah.
Let me ask you about margarine. I've heard horror stories. I mean, when you put margarine in the trunk of your car and leave it there for the whole month of July, and it gets to be like 180, and at the end of the month, the margarine is in exactly the same condition as when you put it in there, that makes me think it ain't good for you.
I'm not a big fan of margarine. I think of all the non-animal fat sources, I think olive oil is our best bet.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so maybe what you can do is, can you give us an idea, Dr. Wortman, of what people would have eaten for breakfast, lunch, maybe it's just a typical meal in the day? Maybe you can just describe some of those foods.
She's referring, of course, for our listeners, yes, to the CBC documentary, My Big Fat Diet. I mean, you talked about what they ditched. What did you put on their plate?
Well, we had part of the study protocol. I visited the community often, and we had cooking classes and potluck meals, and I taught them how to make my breakfast frittata. And I think a lot of people ate that, which is an egg dish made with eggs, cream, and cheese, and it's baked or cooked on the cooktop and then grilled under the broiler. And that could be accompanied with a breakfast meat like ham, bacon, or sausage, and maybe a small bit of tomato with some mayonnaise. So that would be a typical breakfast.
Mm-hmm. And how about lunch or dinner?
Lunch could be, I would often eat lunch in the local diner, so I would order their biggest burger combo, you know, mushroom cheese bacon burger without the bun.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I'm going to get you to repeat that, because I just heard a round of applause from our audience.
Well, if I travel a lot. If I'm on the road and I need to have a quick lunch, I'll go to a fast food outlet and I'll order a big hamburger, but I'll take the bun off and I won't have relish or ketchup with it. So I'm eating a low-carb version of a hamburger.
But I thought in the list we talked about a few moments ago, the first item you ditched was pop, the second was sugary foods, and then you said no fast food.
We in our household, we rarely do that, but when you're traveling, sometimes you have no choice, and you have to figure out how to accommodate this kind of a diet in the real world. So we mentioned the Atkins book recently. They have a whole section on that, all the different branded restaurant chains and what you could eat on their menu.
Now, with regards to your study again, you were targeting traditional foods with regards to the First Nations people, and you've done a lot of work with these people. How are they embracing this? I mean, you're working directly with them. How are these people you know, embracing the research? Are they integrating it into their tribes?
I have become pretty famous in First Nations communities because of that documentary. So when I go around, I hear stories. People come up, sometimes quietly, they'll come up to me and they'll say, I'll give you an example. Recently, a woman came up to me, she's a nurse, and she said, I saw your documentary, I gave it to my son, he lost over 70 pounds, and now we're out hiking and canoeing together.
Mm.
So it's kind of creeping around out there, it's building a little bit, but there hasn't been it hasn't been totally embraced, let me put it that way.
And have you done any calculations with regards to, helping with costs in healthcare? What would be any potential short-term, long-term savings if people could learn and adapt this diet some more?
And I'll add to that that our health minister in Ontario, Deb Matthews, lives right here in London and may well be listening. So go for it.
Well, the potential savings are significant. There was a study in Ontario recently that showed if you have a diagnosis of diabetes compared to somebody who doesn't, you consume more than double the cost in terms of healthcare services. Mm-hmm. I have examples of people. One fellow came up to me recently who got off all his medications, and he said, I'm saving myself $500 a month by eating this way. So I think the potential cost to the system, both in the direct cost of drugs and direct care, plus the overall benefit of having healthier people, is enormous. And I think the system is going to buckle under these costs of this rising epidemic of chronic disease.
Now we have
so
to.
I think this is really important.
Okay, yeah. Now you just, that last 10 seconds, now you're on the hood of the car. Can you repeat what you just said? That's the theme of our show, the last 10 seconds of what you said.
Well, I think the cost is enormous of this chronic disease epidemic, and changes like this don't cost anything and have the potential of saving a tremendous amount of money.
So what you're doing is you're reaching through the radio, grabbing our Ontario Health Minister, Deb Matthews, by the scruff of her frilly collar and saying, listen, the answer is not drugs, it's better diet, 3 square meals, just like Pam Colleen keeps telling you.
In a nutshell, yes.
And you teach at the Faculty of Medicine at UBC, correct?
They let me talk to the students once in a while, yes.
Okay. I was going to say, in medical schools, how much do doctors learn about nutrition, doctor?
Very little. I do a lecture every year, and I think they might get maybe two lectures in their whole medical education on nutrition, on obesity.
I mean, how are we going to do this? How are we going to get this information into the medical schools?
That's a good one. I think the big authorities need to shift their position. So I think some effort has to be put into getting them to change.
And you did a one-year study. Do you see anything in the future with regards to prolonging this study or doing extra research on this area?
A lot of research is being done in the general population in the U.S. mainly. Some is in Europe and some is in Middle East, for instance, other places like that. And I think the cumulative effect of the increasing amount of research will eventually shift the recommendation.
Dr. J, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to throw you this challenge. I'm going to imagine that our health minister, Deb Matthews, is listening. She is totally overwhelmed by the rising debt level in Ontario because of our health care costs. And she's saying to you, Dr. J, if you're so smart, give me the prescription for how I fix the health of the people of Ontario. Will you have a prescription for us when we come back?
I'll stick my neck out.
There we go. Dr. J will be back with us in just a moment here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK. During the break, I asked Pam a blunt question. I said, you hold these boot camps in which you tell people it's all about nutrition. It's all about what you eat. And I said to Pam, what are the issues that the people who come to your boot camps are dealing with? And you said,
well, depression, fatigue, anxiety, sleep problems, addiction, they're all kind of connected. And these are people who are falling through the cracks. They struggle every single day because of their psychological issues. They get labeled by society as being lazy or neurotic or whatever the case may be. And really what they're struggling with is malnutrition. So when they start increasing their intake of animal fat, what I see typically is their mood improves. Their behavior improves. Their cravings for sugar go down or are totally eliminated.
Low energy.
Oh, yeah, low energy.
Low sex drive.
Low libido, yeah.
And all those things leading to depression and mm-hmm. a host of other issues.
Mm-hmm.
In conversation with Dr. J. Wortman, the man behind My Big Fat Diet on the CBC. Dr. J., let me ask you, the CBC Now is a series called Village on a Diet.
Yes.
Can you watch that show?
I find it difficult at times.
Why?
I find it very difficult to watch. In fact, I watched one episode. I got so frustrated.
Why, Pam?
Well, because they're promoting a low fat and they're promoting things like soy and they have morbidly obese people running up and down hills. I'm like, you don't do that to people who are morbidly obese.
Why can't you watch it, Dr. J?
For basically the same reasons. It's clearly designed to be an entertainment show and the diet exercise is really just part of the entertainment package.
So you don't take people who are sicker, fatter, and more depressed than ever and just say, well, get on the treadmill.
Well, they have, overweight women crying because they can't do the extreme exercise, and that makes for good dramatic TV, but it's not the right approach.
You see, when you consider diet, Andy, you have to consider things like mood and fertility and so on. And when you start removing animal fats from the diet, those things are adversely affected, and nobody's looking at that. Nobody's looking at the long-term effects on mood and libido.
Back to the phone lines we go. Jerry, you have a question.
Hi, very simple. About a year ago, a friend of mine talked me into this, all these wonderful foods that your guests are constantly talking about. I went and got the groceries. It cost me three times as much money for the 1 week than I normally spend.
Well, Jerry, I know you...
wonderful things. Why don't your guests get the government to lower the prices on the good food and make it more expensive for the junk?
Well, there's a loaded question. By the way, I know Jerry, and Jerry's loaded, so it's not a problem. So you are eating healthy, right, Jerry?
I think so.
Let me ask you about the basic premise of all of this, that you are what you eat, and it's through what you eat that your health is going to improve, not through all the drugs that you take.
Well, I think you're right, because I'm like Sylvester Stallone. If I had a choice of diet, it'd be fish, fish, and fish, and I swim real well.
Okay, Jerry, I appreciate the... he's also a comedian on the side. Dr. J, I asked you earlier about giving us a snapshot of our health in North America, and you basically, in your own calm, pondered way, said, we're in pretty bad shape, and it's getting worse. How do we change it, Dr. J?
Well, I think we're here talking about this together because we agree that diet is the major contributor to this. And that's where the change has to occur.
So why is it that there's such a disconnect? Why is it that when people go to a medical doctor today, they may get diagnosed with diabetes, insulin resistance, what have you, and the dietary advice they're getting is it contradicts everything that you and I are saying?
That's the million-dollar question, Pam. Mm-hmm. The medical education doesn't focus on nutrition. I think our profession made a mistake decades and decades ago when we abandoned that and started chasing after drugs and fancy technology.
Would we be a lot better off if we stopped going to the doctor and went to the Pam Colleens of the world to their nutrition boot camps?
Well, the problem there is that the mainstream advice you get in nutrition wouldn't steer you in this direction. And I think that's where some of the change has to occur.
In other words, it's bad nutrition advice. We go back to the phones. John, your comment.
Yeah, I just had a quick question. Fructose keeps coming up over and over again. Fructose is also found in fruits, and I was always under the impression that with all the antioxidants and all the good colors and then all the fresh fruits that they're out there, does that apply to fruits? I understand the point about the high fructose corn syrup, but what about the raspberries? What about the blueberries? What about all the good fruits that we got?
Dr. J?
Well, my take on that is if you don't have insulin resistance and therefore your sensitivity is very high to these things, if you eat whole fruit and that's your only source of fructose, you're going to be fine.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I eat some fruit. I just don't overdose on fruit. Fructose is very hard on the liver. And we want to enjoy these fruits, especially your, deep pigmented fruits like the ones you mentioned, like mm-hmm. blueberries and raspberries. They will give you the antioxidants. So there is a lot of benefit to eating these berries, for example. But I don't overeat them.
Oh, now with your diet too, is there a risk of becoming too acid in your system? Because all the foods that you're talking about are very acidic.
Mm-hmm.
But alkaline.
But we know though that by eating these foods historically, it kept us healthy. So the acid and alkaline thing to me is I used to believe in that, and it's very, very loosey goosey, let's just say.
John, I appreciate the call. Let's go to Rick. Rick, your question or comment.
Hi, folks. Good to talk to you. I have a family member that is just like this, depression, fatigue, and all those kinds of things. And we've been to see a naturopath and found out that this person has a high sensitivity to dairy and egg products. And so how does that work into this whole system?
Dr. J.
I don't deal with those kinds of issues, but my thinking is that naturopaths tend to have more of an emphasis on nutrition and diet, which is good. And I'm not always 100% clear. It's not always clear to me how they arrive at these diagnoses. So not an area I can really comment.
Can you, Pam, can you make a comment for Rick?
Naturopaths have different training. A lot of them, I find, still do perpetuate the low-fat diet. Some, though, are coming over to the other side and realizing the importance of animal fats. I'd say they're in the minority, though. As people get more acquainted with the importance of animal fats, they get healthier and healthier typically, and there's less need for things like supplementation.
Rick, I appreciate the call. Jay, we're almost out of time. Summarize everything you've said so that people can walk away with that little banner of advice.
Well, for anyone who has developed insulin resistance or the conditions related to insulin resistance, what the science is telling us is that carbohydrate restriction will help. And the best advice right now, the best way of doing that is from a popular diet book, the new Atkins diet book. The new one, I think, is the best guide right now. And that came out a few months ago. And it's also important for people that are taking medications for any of these conditions that they do this in consultation with their doctor, because your need for the medications will drop. People get off their drugs. But if they don't do that, if they do the diet and they take the drugs, they can get themselves into trouble. So that's, in a nutshell, my advice to people, and it's always best to do these things in cooperation with your doctor.
Dr. J, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Really appreciate you joining us this morning. Pam, you are setting up your boot camp this fall.
Yes.
We get email all the time. Where can I get in touch
with
Pam?
Well, I have the dates listed on my website under upcoming events. So for every Saturday in October, except Thanksgiving weekend, I'm doing my nutrition boot camp and basically educating people about the importance of returning to traditional foods. The cost is very minimal. It's $25 a class. people can email me and just register a seat, and I'll see you all the month of October.
The basic advice, mm-hmm. the closer you can get to the way it hangs from the tree or on the bush, the way God made it, it's yeah. probably the healthiest way.
And I will say Dr. Jay Wortman has a website, by the way. It's Dr. Jay, J-A-Y, Wortman, W-O-R-T-M-A-N.com, and he's got a blog. So I invite people to visit his blog as well.
See, folks, it's not just Pam Colleen making it up. She's always throwing experts and research at us. And you can check it all out at Pam Colleen's website. Thank you for joining us. Been a lively hour, lively morning. You know the drill. Hands on the wheel, eyes on the road. Because I run into you every day on the way home, and you're looking everywhere except at the road. It makes me really nervous. Please hang up and drive so you arrive alive, and we'll chat again tomorrow morning at 9. Right here on London Today on News Talk 1290 CJBK.